perspectives from you as a follow-up once we've given you this package of what we've heard from everyone else, not just our meetings with the working group members. So with that, I think I'll just hand straight over to Petrina, who's going to just give a bit of background around the feedback we've received on one of these issues, which relates to the definition of the lease. So, Petrina.
Thank you, David. Thank you. Hello. I know that some of you I'd seen via done the video conference line, but not in person. So anyway, it's very, very nice to see you in person and speak to you directly today. And obviously when I've been speaking to you down the video line or telephone line, one of the things that I've been following up with first and foremost is the definition of a lease. And of course trying to work out what is that right line between, you know, what contracts actually contain a lease versus those that are services. As I say, you're obviously familiar with the targeted outreach paper and what we discussed, but just to recap on the sort of the four main areas or the four questions, I suppose, in a sense that we were trying to answer in terms of working out the definition of a lease. We'll just recap. I think within the targeted outreach paper, they're in paragraph four of that paper, but they're really were two getting at what do we think specified asset means within the definition of a lease. What should an asset be? When we talk about a right to use an asset, what is the asset? Do we think that that asset should be something that is a sort of uniquely identifiable or really identifiable asset? Or do we think it's enough that it could be an asset of a particular specification? So, you know, for example, if there is a contract for the use of a certain number of assets just of a particular, say, make or specification or functionality, is that enough to say, in terms of specified assets, to say that could be the subject of a lease? Or do we actually think that the assets need to be really identifiable. And the second thing sort of linked to the specified asset piece was, do we think that portions of a larger sort of physical asset could be the subject of a lease? And I think where we all are in that and the boards are the clearly physically distinct portions. So, you know, the floor in this building can be the subject of a lease, but what if we go and start to talk about some of the capacity portions, capacity portions of a pipeline, et cetera? Do we think those can be the subject of a lease? I think that the second two pieces link more into control. The first is the control and controlling the use. What do we think that means? And, of course, the board's had some preliminary discussions on this, not only in February but last week, and I think one thing that came across in that discussion is that when we look at the definition of a lease, the word control isn't actually used in the definition. Our definition actually is that a lease is something where the customer gets the right to use an asset. Where, of course, control has been used and where we're proposing to still use control in that definition is working out, does the customer really have a right of use, a right to use the asset? And how the definition sort of works, and I think when we think about it, is we kind of think you know that the customer has actually got a right to use when it controls the use of the asset during the period of the contract. So that's where we're always thinking about controlling the use. And when we think about that controlling the use, we are thinking about the asset, the underlying asset. So does the customer actually retain the ability to control the use of the underlying asset? There were two proposals in the targeted outreach paper, obviously, around whether we think that we should sort of stick closer to how it's defined today and current GAAP and what was proposed in the exposure draft, where we've got the sort of the A, B, and C criteria, any one of those, I mean the customer's the right to control the use, versus do we move to something that would possibly be closer to some of the other projects, particularly the revenue recognition project, where they use the notion of controlling the use to try and work out, when there's really when a seller can really recognise revenue by looking at whether the customer obtains the ability to control the use of the asset. And I think the last piece that we'll come back to was a question around some sort of wording around assets being incidental to the delivery of services, whether it would make sense to try and add some words within the definition of a lease around that. I think maybe just to, as I say, we spoke to you, but maybe just to give you some idea of the sort of overall comments that we got around these four questions when we talked to you and to others, to prepare groups and to the accounting firms around the questions. I think that in general, when we looked at the specified asset piece, there sort of was a message, or the general message that came back, was that people were, certainly the majority of people, were keener to stick with a sort of narrower notion of specified assets. So where we currently are today, in current guidance and in the exposure draft, so that it really should be an identifiable asset. I think some of the thoughts around that, I think certainly for some people, I think being able to identify the asset was really important. It's actually essential to some people in terms of the definition of a lease. To know whether you have a right to use an asset, we really need to be able to see and identify that asset. I think some of the other comments that we raised around that was that if we went to a sort of broader notion of an asset of a particular specification, that how does that work, particularly maybe not even so much from the lessee's perspective, but maybe from the lessor's perspective, in terms of if they were derecognising an asset or portion of an asset, if we don't know exactly what the asset is, how does the lessor work out what he's derecognising, if that's the model that's being used to actually derecognise an asset. I think the other comments that we got, I think from some of you as well as others, is that maybe from a sort of theoretical standpoint, it makes sense that an asset of a particular specification could be subject of a lease. So if the contract actually said, you've got the right to use that. One example that was brought up with the targeted outreach is a sort of a contract that said you could use 7 towboats over a period of 3 years, but those towboats weren't specifically identified. It could be seven from any number of a pool of towboats. Well, surely that could be the subject of a lease. But I think some people who even acknowledged that we think that could be, they felt that the definition of control, in a sense, might bring you back sometimes to the same place, which is the contract may not contain a lease. If you even looked wider and sort of widened the definition around specified asset, you might look wider and say, oh, maybe this is a lease, oh, but I don't control it, therefore in the end I don't end up with a lease. So I think in terms of where our staff recommendation has gone on this, I think we did hear quite a lot of that, and when we came back and looked at some examples, we have thought around, is it worthwhile sort of expanding the definition in the sense around specified asset to possibly then, when you come and look at control, end up in the situation where we're in the same place. So as I say, based on the feedback we received, our recommendation as staff going forward to the boards this week is that we would stick with a narrower notion of specified asset. Both in terms of sort of particular specification and also in terms of portions. Just to mention in terms of portions, one thing that we have thought about is that if we sort of clarify that a physically distinct portion of an asset can be the subject of a lease, so as I said, a floor of a building, but the sort of capacity portions that are not physically distinct would not be. I think just an example that we've thought of that draws out the difference there is probably that in the telecommunications sector where you have sort of fibre optic cables, where you can sort of physically, you can identify particular strands or even possibly particular colours or wavelengths within strands, that possibly would meet our definition of being physically distinct. It is somehow possible that one person, you can sort of separate one strand from the other strands. And even there, a link might be thinking about sort of exclusivity, that a customer, in a sense, who has access and a right to use a particular strand of a cable, it is possible that they can have sort of exclusive use of that strand and then possibly the right to use that strand. I think where we think we wouldn't go to is therefore something like a capacity portion of a pipeline that would actually be excluded from being considered to be a lease. Because if you think about a pipeline, we think that it's pretty difficult to think about a portion of one pipeline actually being physically distinct from the rest. It really can't be sort of separated from the rest. I'm just going to, if we think around control, there are still the two proposals that you had in your targeted outreach are still being discussed by the board this week. I think that the comments we got back in general around control was that I think that definitely the majority of people we talked to were supportive of moving control to be more aligned with other projects, particularly the revenue project and how it's explored control. I think, again, for a number of reasons, I think some people were attracted to trying to obviously apply control in a more consistent basis across different situations. And I think particularly the link with revenue from from a lessor perspective, people definitely thought that that link to how revenue is looking at control and controlling the use made sense. I think for some others, they felt that the changed definition of control would get them to a better place, provide a better basis of working out whether you've got a lease or a service. And for instance, particularly those that we talked to in the utility sector, I think some of the power purchase agreements that obviously were the subject, or were certainly in the frame whenever 018 and IFRIC 4 were written, when we talked to those preparers, they certainly were quite supportive of moving to that slightly different control notion that had sort of a power and benefits piece, because they acknowledge and they think it's likely that if we did move, some of their power purchase agreements, some of those take-or-pay contracts, may no longer be to be considered lease contracts, but they felt that was the right answer. It got them to the right place in terms of what is considered to be lease. So from their point of view, those contracts are for services, don't necessarily contain a lease. And I think around control, what we also heard was there certainly were some, and the accounting firms in particular had still some concerns, of course, in terms of moving away from what we've currently got. And obviously just raising, would there be any possibly unintended consequences that might come from that? Also, again, particularly linking back and thinking about maybe some of those power purchase agreements or some of the others, that I think if we do change the definition of control, it is moving away slightly from what was the intent and objective, in a sense, at the time that 018 was written, or IFRIC 4. So we would be essentially changing the goalposts somewhat in terms of how we define the lease, or what we think, or what contracts we think would be caught by the definition of a lease. And again, some of those concerns came across in terms of moving to something new. I think the last piece, and sorry, maybe to what I haven't told you, is then in terms of our staff recommendation for this week in terms of around control, we have got both views presented there, and there are actually some staff are recommending going to sort of closer to the revenue project in terms of control, and some staff would recommend staying closer to where we've got. Just to clarify that if we do stick with what we've got closely, we still would recommend making some minimal changes, in a sense, that would address some of the current practice issues, particularly around what does fixed price per unit mean, what does current market price mean. So some of that terminology that has raised some questions today, so we'd still address some of those comments. I think the final piece is assets that are incidental to the delivery of services. In the paper you got, obviously, we had proposed some words in there around assets being incidental. And I think when we spoke, to you and others, I think a lot of people are quite attracted to the idea of recognising or putting something in there that really tries to catch those situations where we really think this contract is wholeheartedly for services. Clearly, in delivering a service, you need to use assets. The seller or the supplier needs to use assets to deliver that service. And maybe even sometimes it might be a particular specified asset that has to be used. But we really still think this is all about services, and it's just that as a consequence of delivering the service, you need to use an asset to deliver the service. But the contract doesn't actually give the customer a right to use the asset. And as I say, a lot of people attracted to those words, but I think there were a lot of questions raised around how do we really make those words operational. I think we need application examples to help us work out what contracts do the boards think they want to catch with this, and what contracts should be excluded. So I think what we've done in our thinking about this in our staff recommendations this week is that we did go back and think about what do we think we're trying to capture with this. And I think one thing that came across to us is that the way we had done this in the targeted outreach, it almost looked like this was a third piece, in the sense you've got specified asset, you've got control, and then you've got incidental asset, and how does that work? So I think what we've done is when we've looked at the words and what we are trying to capture, we actually see this, if we are going to include something around this area, we see it fitting almost within control, in a sense. And how we look at it is that when we thought about assets being incidental, we've actually thought about how what are we talking about, and some of the words we had in the targeted outreach we fed off, where we thought about it in a situation where we're saying that what the customer is really getting is a service, and in fact any use of an asset in delivering that service is really sort of inseparable. It's just a piece of getting an overriding service versus a situation where the customer really is getting the right to use an asset and maybe getting some services attached to it. So what we've actually done in the paper is we're actually recommending embedding this notion of not using the word incidental anymore, but embedding the notion of the use of an asset being separable from any other services that might be delivered, and then thinking about that under the umbrella of controlling the use. So what we'd actually say is if there is a contract where the use of the asset in a sense would be separable from the rest, it's really that the customer has got the right to use an asset and it's actually contracted and asked the supplier to deliver some services along with it. If it's a situation where the use of the asset is really just a completely integrated part of delivering the overall service, the contract is really just for services and therefore wouldn't fall into the scope of the leases standard. And maybe I'll just give one example around that to help put in picture, is that when we were thinking about this inseparable notion, I think the thinking there is similar to some of the thinking in the revenue project around separate performance obligations. What we've kind of been thinking about is say that if there's a construction site here, and maybe the construction site is such that particular specialised cranes or equipment has to be used. It could even be that in constructing this building, the cranes and the equipment will end up being on site for 2 or 3 years. But if the contract is just such that, you know, the owner ultimately of the building just wants a building constructed, that any use of the sort of cranes or specialised equipment in that, we would view as simply being an integrated part of the overall delivery of a service, which is construction services and building. In building that building, we wouldn't expect the owner, in a sense, we don't think in that case, he is actually contracted for the right to use the cranes and the specialised equipment over that 3-year period. It's simply their use as an integrated part of getting the construction services. And I think that would be sort of different from another situation, where it might be the case that the customer, you know, maybe provided, so maybe I'll even use this floor of the building in a sense or whatever as an example where it may be that there are some services that are attached to using this floor. We must have use of the lift. You know, we perhaps must take some of the security services in a sense. They may be considered to be attached, but that's not our notion of separability that we think of as not that. Because what we'd say in this case is, in the ISB's use of this floor, the ISB absolutely controls the use of this floor. We make all of the decisions about who comes into the building, how this floor is used, you know, what furniture is put in here, etc. So that's not the situation we intend to catch when we think about the separability notion. So again, with that is something that we're proposing that if the boards decide they like that would be sort of embedded within the notion of control. So maybe with that, I've definitely talked way too much at this point. And so what I'd like to do is hand over to you for any comments in particular or questions on what I've said or any of your views around how you think these should be defined.
Thanks, Petrina. Teeing that up, I think you've identified a number of areas where we'd certainly like some feedback on, and I think it's not only the feedback you've received, but I think also the direction the staff's heading in terms of recommendations for the board. As I said before, good opportunity for you to give us timely input. So, Kevin, I think you'd like to come in first.
Yeah. Petrina, I read the paper that was discussed last week at the education sessions, and again, I took that paper and applied it in our circumstance, and we're a miner operating in 27 different countries around the world. And the situation we have is that we do use mining equipment that is supplied by a mining processor who will, in essence, haul the ore after we've blasted it. And the things that sort of I was sitting here is most of we have only about 4 mining contractors at any of our 20 mines. They invariably, for tax reasons, establish a separate subsidiary in that particular country. And in one country, we're the sole user of that subsidiary. But it actually operates under a performance guarantee by its holding company. And so currently, under the current GAAP, we've looked through the wholly owned subsidiary and said, no, it's just a performance guarantee that overrides that control of 100% of that subsidiary's operations. Are you still expecting that type of situation to flow through?
So I'm sorry, just to clarify, are you saying that...
I'll make it very specific. We have a mine in Mali, which the mining contract has established a separate Malian subsidiary.
Mm-hmm.
But that, and we are the only only receiver of the services from that Malian subsidiary.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets, it has, or we've received a performance guarantee from its holding company, who have other contracts with us in adjoining countries. I'm not looking to that because we are the sole receiver of 100% of that subsidiary's benefits, that it would still get captured within the lease if I, on a control mechanism,
mm-hmm.
because I look through currently and say the performance guarantee that its holding company has established
mm-hmm.
breaks that control mechanism of receiving 100% of the operations of that subsidiary because they set it up for tax reasons and other country jurisdictional reasons. They didn't set it up in order to limit liability and limit performance and everything else with me. So I'd still be looking to say a performance guarantee from the holding company
mm-hmm.
would be some of the evidence I'd use to reduce the control mechanism because the adjoining countries I already get an ability for them to bring in other equipment, move it out, and so forth. And I'd be looking for performance guarantees would still be used as part of my evidence.
So are you saying that today the performance guarantee is used to sort of break that legal separation
yeah.
to say that, that you'll come along and say, you, from even from a consolidation perspective,
yeah.
that you would actually be consolidating that? I think we don't intend to change how that would be applied in a sense. So I think you'd still look at
still
the,
be able to break
yeah.
it.
There's not an idea that the way you know the way that the performance the way you'd look at your bundle of contracts or things
yeah.
to consider, we wouldn't be changing that.
Okay, and then you're saying in your definitions, you said that on substantive rights,
mm-hmm.
It says that a supplier's right to substitute be substantive only when A, it is practically and economically feasible or rational for the supplier to substitute the asset, and the supplier can substitute the asset at any time without requiring the customer's consent. Well, I'm not letting him onto my site unreservedly at all opportunities. I have safety mechanisms, I have security, and all sorts of other things. There's got to be, you know, not this dogmatic at any time. It's got to be, you know, at the moment my contracts allow for which he can substitute the asset, for which I can't unreasonably withhold consent. But I know the auditors would look at any time as a fairly dogmatic statement, and that just seems a bit too pedantic.
Just so you know, I'll take your point. I'm interested in other people's comments around that one in particular. We are already aware that the exact wording of that I think we need to work on, because I suppose it's not that, as you say, for safety, that you maybe there's a barrier at the door. Even to get inside someone's premises, you need to ask for their permission,
yeah.
or to get on site, you need to ask for permission, but you could, you know, freely move the asset. We're not intending it to be, you know, as strict as I say, almost applying, because an example here would be that if somebody clearly has to get our permission to come into our building in order to, for example, replace a photocopier, etc. It's not that we intend that consent to apply at a different level of asset to the actual asset itself. So I think we are aware we need to think about the words around that.
Thanks, Kevin. Russ?
Yeah, I want to focus more on this substitution rights. When I read, personally, when I read specified assets versus specifiable, specified assets, my initial reaction is a lot easier to track, but I get nervous about how easy it would be to structure around it. That's what the substitution rights are designed to do. So I have a question for you, Kevin, and a question for John. Why economically do you allow for the lessor to substitute their assets for you? And then John, on your leasing business related to copiers, today you have they're specified in the contract. How easy would it be for General Electric or other lessors that, in essence, lease a big book of business of similar assets to change that, to not specify it? Would it impact your business from a lessor perspective?
Okay, the reason why we allow the change in building an open pit mine that's going to last 15, 20 years, the volume of ore, the density of the ore, the way that the ore breaks after the initial explosion, means that sometimes you only need 25-ton trucks to move it efficiently to the central processor. Sometimes you need 50-ton trucks. You know, just and as you when you first blast, the ore tends to break in the very large boulders that we're sort of used to. As you've been blasting over 4 or 5 years, ore breaks in much smaller components, and therefore you just don't need, you know, the size of the truck anymore to efficiently move the ore, and therefore we allow that substitution effectively over time.
But you're the one driving substitution, not the lessor. Is that
right? No, because when we set the mine plan originally, the lessor is fully aware of this, and therefore one of the proposals would be that we establish our mine plan. He then would work out that for the first 2 or 3 years of this 8-10 year contract, because these are not 1 year, 2 year contracts, for the first couple of years, he knows he would need 50-ton trucks because of the way that the ore is going to break and where it's going to be moved to and so forth. As it moves into another stage, it would change. He can see from our mine plan that we've given him initially at the initial contract which is the way to work out which trucks you'll need at some future time. It's not, you know, it's not set regularly. He supplies the drivers. He supplies the truck. Our only duty is to keep with the mine plan. And we'll know if our mine plan's going off tack at least 18 months before it goes off tack. It doesn't go off tack next week.
Just a minute, Weibo.
When we are talking about substitution, I think maybe the board member's idea is very simple. You have one contract and one piece of machine, and whether this piece of machine can be substituted under some conditions. But as I understand, what you are talking is actually different contract. Different stage, you may sign with the C and lessor may sign contracts composed of different trucks.
No. Invariably, our contract is one where we require them to move X tons of ore on an annual basis, literally from the blast site through to the processing mill. We will direct the blasting. We do all of that. So once the blast has occurred, they come in, take the ore, and move it to the processor where it gets ground. Depending on how the ore breaks, depends on the size of trucks that you actually need. It's not the ore breaks in gold mining because of the way our pits work. It, you know, one day you'll end up with in the first couple of years, they'll be bigger than the size of these tables. As you move through that initial break, they'll be half the size of these tables, and you can use more efficient trucks as you move through. But it's a contract to deliver ore for which they have to use the trucks, which you can't put them on people's backs. So it's contracts for delivering ore to the processing plant. It's a tonnage. They get paid based on tonnage. They don't get paid based on kilometres, truck drives, or anything else.
Kevin, is that a business practice that you apply in only some situations, certain countries? This is across all
of the
mining.
We either own the trucks ourselves, but in some of the locations, especially when we've got multiple mines in a close geographic area, we'll own the trucks ourselves. And we'll ourselves ship trucks around at the multiple mine sites. But where we have single mine sites in single countries,
that's when you use this.
That's when we use the contract miner, and it's tonnage-based. And in South America, we have a mine in southern Patagonia, 400 kilometres north of Tierra del Fuego. 2 months of the year, they can't move anything, and they get paid nothing, because there's just nothing you can do at that time of the year. The sun's not up enough, and the wind's blowing so high that you can't walk.
So in those other situations, you own outright, you don't lease the trucks?
The ones where we own outright.
Right, okay. Now, I think you asked John a question, didn't you, as well, Russ?
Yeah. Okay. With regards to substitution, let me start at copy machines. Our business is fundamentally that of a finance lessor. We are not a manufacturer of copy machines. So what we're doing is, you know, the machine is probably delivered directly to the customer. We're funding the manufacturer, and then we have a lease receivable from the customer. You know, we're really not... You know, we don't really want to take any operating risk with regards to the asset, or we don't really want to be worried about redeploying it if it comes back and we're substituting in. I think as a practical matter, with something like that in our situation, being able to substitute would probably not be we wouldn't want that feature in a contract. If you're dealing with things that are difficult to move as well, I think there's a lot of reasons why you probably wouldn't have substitution. I think it would have to be, to the extent that, to the extent something could occur, I think you'd have to deal with long-lived assets with very low technological obsolescence characteristics around them for maybe some people structure transactions with substitutability.
Now, I'm not sure whether it's Anne or Rich. Rich.
Just a couple comments. On the substitution issue, I guess I know that one of the examples the boards talk about is where you have the chassis at the rail yard and the lessee can pick one up and return it and get another one, but they're committed to keep one chassis for 5 years, for example. It's just they're going to keep rotating it in and out. If that's a substitution issue the boards are looking at, it would seem there's one way to deal with that, which is that's a five-year lease of a chassis, and you have to lease a chassis for 5 years unless you return it and take another one on. Where it becomes complicated is this two-lease model that you've headed down, because I don't know how to apply that when I don't know what the asset is. So I guess one observation is, depending on how complicated we make these substitution rules, it's going to make applying, whether it's a, I'll call it an operating lease or a finance lease, even though operating lease is on balance sheet, which of those two models to apply. So I think that's the first piece. On the mining example, if it's actually a third party operating those trucks, I have no idea why that's a lease, but that's just me. In the summary, you mentioned that fiber optic colors would be a lease. Just an observation there. I think when I first looked at IRU contracts, there were 8 colors in a fiber. Last time I looked, I think there were 64 colors in a fiber. So why we would ever want to get into capacity, especially capacity when it can change over time as technology changes, I don't know. I think the observation of the staff that capacity arrangements, when it's a portion of the capacity of a physical asset, shouldn't be leases, makes perfect sense to me. And expanding leasing to those capacity arrangements is a dramatic increase in lease accounting. The other item was telecoms and definition of control. We talked about, payments and whether or not they actually controlled the asset. I know principally it makes sense to do scope first. My one observation is, depending on what you do with contingent rentals, you'll take a lot of pressure off this issue. So, for example, if all contingent rentals are simply recognized when incurred, where you have these 100% contingent rental arrangements based solely on output, you're not going to worry about it because you're going to recognize them when incurred. If, however, you put some form of contingent rentals on balance sheet, it's going to make the scope issue a lot more complicated. So I know that's backwards, but I would almost say think about contingent rentals first, and if you follow our recommendation and don't require entities to recognize them until they occur, I think it'll take off some of the pressure on these capacity arrangements. Because the true financing capacity arrangements, there's a fixed capacity charge, and that would go on balance sheet if it's a lease, and the variable piece would stay off. For the ones where it's truly simply buying a service, chances are it's fully variable, and you can deal with that through contingent rentals. So those are just some observations.
Can I ask you a question on the comment you made about capacity leases? I think I heard you say this would be a dramatic expansion of number of leases.
Like 10% of the Alaska pipeline would.
Okay, that may be an observation of, a practical implication of the approach that I think the staff are proposing. You're not saying that you don't think they would meet the definition of a lease, that you would have control over?
Just to be clear, I do not think if you have 10% of the capacity of the Alaska pipeline, you have a lease.
No, I'm talking about the fiber optic cable where you actually have control over a wavelength within a...
Well, if you have a color in the fiber, my understanding is that means there's a separate party transmitting and receiving it to split those colors as opposed to you. Personally, I don't think that's a lease, especially if there's an ability to expand the transmission capability of that fiber and the owner keeps that. Because what are you leasing then? You're leasing a ever-growing smaller portion of that asset, and that doesn't seem to make sense to me. It's almost like if you were leasing this floor, except if I saw you were only sitting there, then I could bring all my people in and sit around you. That doesn't really sound like you have a lease on the floor. It sounds like you're sitting in my floor, actually, at that point.
So is it the fact that the benefits embodied in that item could change that
Yeah, that is part of it. But to be clear, when you get to like oil capacity, you know, capacity on an oil or natural gas pipeline, I guess my theory of what a lease is, it's for the right to use an asset, not a portion of that asset, especially a small portion of that asset. It's the right to use that asset. And if you only have a small portion of the capacity of that asset, I would not have put that into lease again.
Okay, thank you. Pat, I think you were next.
Thank you. I wanted to come back to something that Petrina teed up here in the context of a paper that was discussed in an Ed session by both the FASB and the ISB this week. It's paper 1D, and it's paragraph 36, and it goes to how we are going to evaluate whether something meets the definition of a lease. And the staff's rationale for the towboat example is essentially that in that scenario, a supplier is controlling the use of towboats, not the customer. So in my view, even though we might have a definition of a lease that could be perhaps more expansive in the view of some people, we're talking about a specific kind of asset as opposed to an asset. In my view, this interpretation of the application of the definition would be restrictive. And I want to get your sense as to whether or not you agree with that, because I think this also will drive the outcome of the question about whether an asset is incidental to the rendering of a service. Who is actually controlling the use of the asset? If the supplier is controlling the use for purposes of renting the service, my view, it's a service, notwithstanding whether or not you have a specific asset or a specific kind of asset. And I think this is a critical point to focus on. That's why I'm not troubled with a more expansive perspective on the definition of a lease, because as you know, I know we've had discussions before with some of you, I think if you're going to restrict it to a specific asset, then it's very easy to step outside of lease accounting. All you have to do is say it's only this specific asset with the serial number, hence it's, you know, it is a lease, or if you don't want it to be a lease, you don't specify a specific asset. So if we're talking about, if the thing that's going to drive the definition is this point, who is in control, And I think that's also related to the question of whether it's incidental. Do you agree with that interpretation? If not, where are we being too liberal, if you will, in our thinking?
So feel free to respond to Pat's question, but before we get to others, John, I think you want to come.
I had something else I want.
Okay. Does someone want to respond, Mark?
To respond to Pat, I hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure where it takes us, because I think you get to the same place either way. If you take an expansive definition of what's a specified asset, and so it's not a specified asset anymore, it's a class of asset or a type of asset, effectively, yes, you're right, you're probably more likely to take that deal out of the leasing standard, because the control element is less likely to be there if the supplier is effectively choosing amongst his pool of assets which one he uses to provide that service. But are you not there losing sight of where you're trying to go with leases? I mean, my understanding of, you know, where the board's trying to go with the leasing standard is to say that there are arrangements which are called leases, which are akin to the purchase of all, a large part, a medium part, or a small part of the life of an asset, and we want to put an amount which is equivalent to nearly the whole value of the same asset if it was purchased, or half of it, or a quarter of it, or whatever. But you're always talking about an asset. You need to be able to identify that asset, particularly if you're, as a lessor, if you're going to account for that asset properly. You've got to look at the lessor accounting side of things, because that's what's, I think, missing in what you're saying. As a lessor, if you own 100 towboats, if you're being asked to de-recognize them because part of them because you've provided part of their useful life to somebody else, you need to know which ones it is, or else your unit of account becomes your whole pool of towboats. And I don't know how you do that, because some come into the pool, some go out of the pool. They're not all of the same age. Some of them get used up quicker. So I think from the lessor accounting side, it just doesn't work, which is why you've got to look at both lessor and lessee accounting at the same time. But at the end of the day, I think you'll still come to the same place. You'll have a more restrictive definition of a specified asset, and if you have that, you will have fewer deals which will fall out of leasing through the control criteria, because you're more likely to find control when you're in a specific identified asset.
Thanks, Mark. Thomas, you want to come in on that point?
Yes. I think we should go a little bit on the conceptual basis. What is still lacking is there is a convincing reasoning why leases should be treated differently than other executory contracts. But having said that, I think the only issue is that that right of use refers to a specific asset. So the application of that guidance and of that standard will be much easier than we say, okay, leases is different than anything else because it refers to a specific asset. If we say, leases could also be refer to a specification of assets, it will be much broader, it will be much more difficult for the preparers and for the auditors to find out what is the dividing line.
Thanks, Thomas. Anyone else want to come in on this? You did, Bill, did you?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, is your concern that someone just writes a contract and doesn't specify the asset, but in fact it is a specific asset that's delivered, and they're doing that just to avoid lease accounting and avoid capitalization?
One of, yes.
Yeah, I think, can't that be solved by a principle I think we certainly in this room could figure out when that occurs. For instance, I could lease you a 747, and you're going to paint it with your airline's colors, but I didn't specify the tail number of that plane, but we all know that you're going to lease that for 15 or 20 years, even though I might have the right to substitute. I think if it's impractical or there never is an intent of the parties to substitute, then you are leasing a specific asset. If it's impractical, I'm just wondering if there's a principle that we could come up with that deals with this concern that there is going to be just a contract written without specificity of the asset, but it's impractical. It's not really a service, but I tried to make it look like a service. I think we should try to deal with that in a principle or guidance.
We like principles, even if they do give auditors a hard time, so I'll take your advice. Did you want to come back, Pat? Are you?
I'm still listening.
Okay, Larry.
So what would that principle be? Let's take the one that we've talked about ad nauseum, the rail cars. So I'm a company that has to move freight or what have you. I'm not, quote-unquote, leasing these cars from the company that's going to pull the cars. I'm leasing them from GE, let's say. All right, and they have thousands of cars, and I'm leasing, 100 of them. But yet there's a right of substitution in the contract. I'm not painting them to reflect my business at all. I don't care if it's blue, yellow, chartreuse, or what have you. What, just help us with the principle, because I think that's the example that really bothers some of us.
I'm not sure that I'm smart enough to answer your question, but maybe it gets down to control. I control that rail car, and I'm obligated to pay. I'm not sure I understand the contract. Am I obligated to pay a certain amount every month, and I get to use rail cars? Well, I guess if I control those rail cars, Maybe it's the element of control.
Well, that's what the staff said in the paper. I mean, that is the conclusion in paragraph 36. They said, who is controlling the use of the asset? The towboats, actually.
That's correct. Rich, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, could I maybe weigh in on that? I guess in my mind, it comes down to, is the lessee obligated to lease a rail car for 5 years? So they give them a rail car day one. They can turn that in, but the only way they can cancel that lease of that initial rail car is by leasing another rail car. If we didn't have a two-lease model, I could probably make that work pretty easily. With the two-lease model, I have no idea how to make that work because I don't know how to assess the financing element. You know, is it significant or not? For example, if the first rail car I get is 2 years old, I probably don't care if the next one is 15 years old, as long as it'll roll and it'll pass inspections. So if I were going to view that as, say, a five-year lease of the first rail car, then when that's turned in, I have a, you know, four-and-a-half-year lease of the next rail car. Because effectively, that's what I have. I can't get out of that agreement. I just can substitute the asset I'm leasing.
Why does the two-lease concept bother you so much in this example? I mean, these rail cars have a 50-year life.
Well, so instead of a rail car, let's make it a storage container, you know, the cargo containers, where let's assume they have a 15-year life for seaworthiness. And I want one for, you know, I may take a brand new one in the first case and swap it out for a 14-year-old one. I don't know whether a lease of a 14-year-old rail car for 2 years has a significant finance element to it or not, because that's an asset-specific test. So, you know, maybe one way I do it is I end up with the first one's an other than finance lease, the second one's a finance lease, the third one's not. That's where it gets very difficult, and that doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, if we set the hurdle high enough in terms of the distinction between other than finance and finance, that might take care of the problem, which is one of the proposals. It's fairly high.
Depending on what you do. But I think that's the complication here. I mean, otherwise, I think you can find a way to get that substitution of a fungible asset on balance sheet fairly easily, and using a principled approach, I mean, the asset's effectively specified.
We'll come back to the two-lease issue in a moment. But, David, do you want to come in?
Yes, it's the question of control. I mean, the kind of cases where the control is not necessarily with the lessor. An example might be where you pull aircraft engines where when the engine needs to be replaced, it's replaced with another engine. So you're getting a different engine every time it's replaced, but you, at any time, you've got an engine which you control. Would that be a lease?
What do you think?
I think it is. Because you've got a right to an engine for a period of time. It may not be the same engine all that time.
So you then disagree with the staff recommendation that we should be narrowing this to a specified asset? It's an asset of a...
In most cases, I think the control aspect will take it out, but I think there are cases where the control aspect won't. And that gives opportunities for getting things off balance sheet.
Mark?
I just wanted to come in on Larry's question about the rail car and the towboats, because I don't think the two examples are the same. You said in the rail car example you were renting your rail cars from GE or from, you know, a third party finance lessor. In the towboat example, you're asking yourself the question, am I leasing the towboats from a towboat operator? In other words, am I looking through his operations? And you have to go back and look at what the contract says. The towboat contract says that he will drive them up and down the river. He can use a bigger one. He can maybe use two half-sized towboats instead of one full-sized towboat, as long as he transports the amount of coal or ore, in the case of Kevin, because I don't see Kevin's example ever being a lease. Whereas you have to look at the contract that you have with GE. If GE says, here are 10 or 100 rail cars and you're going to pay for them for the next 5 years and then give them back to me, then yeah, you probably have got a lease. If GE is saying I can change them around and I will come and change them and I'll maintain them and I'll make sure that I'll do their safety checks on them, then maybe in that case GE has changed its business model to a degree and is becoming a service provider, in which case you've got a service. You just have to look at what the contract says and the degree of involvement of the asset owner, not to say lessor, the asset owner, in the ongoing life of the asset.
Okay. John, you've been very patient.
Thank you. One of the good things about going toward the end, though, is there's many people have said, you know, things that you wish you said along the way, and that's always very helpful. I generally agree with what Rich's comments with regards to lease versus other arrangements, with the one caveat on the examples he was using, which we'll get to later. But I think that my primary question is, do we really have at this point a good principle separating what is a lease versus what is a service contract and how it's being articulated? Right now, the staff papers are what I call the front part of the document. They're not the basis of conclusion. But based on reading what I'll call various versions of the front part of the document, it's hard for me to develop what that theory is that says this is a lease, this is not a lease, and this is the driving principle behind it. It's like we're drawing lines as to establish, well, this is a line that helps establish where we are, but we're not going back and saying, what is the role of conditionality in payments, to Rich's point? What is, what are we trying to deal with in terms of the rail car versus the towboat, which Mark pointed to? And one you're dealing with, well, you're always dealing just with rail cars, and the other you're probably dealing with a service. The way the existing GAAP guidance under 018 probably worked would say that, well, you probably have a service unless, of course, you're dealing only with a lessor that only has, you know, whatever the number of towboats that's required. Then you kind of almost look through using consolidation type plans. But, you know, broadly, I think that's that makes it very hard for me to assess the proposals in total because I don't see the big picture on it. And the last point on control is that while I think it's useful, I think, to go to the control definition, revenue recognition, that's useful for determining when revenue recognition has occurred. I wonder how useful it will be in total for deciding whether something is a lease or not, or whether it's rev rec, whether it's consolidation. I don't know what the right definition is to go to there. I agree with control, but under what theory?
I don't really understand your point there. I think what staff is saying is we've developed notions of control in other places, consolidation, right, rubric, and so on. It would seem to be appropriate, given that we're talking about whether you've got a right of use that you can direct the benefits from and deny or regulate access to others, that we should use the same notion. Is your concern about how we articulate the notion or whether it should actually be applied in this context?
Well, it's one of those things where I sit back and think of there was a notion of what is control under existing literature and also what was in the exposure draft. There's a separate notion of control and revenue recognition. There's another notion of control and consolidation. Each was developed for their own purposes. And so therefore I'm just saying I don't know if I haven't gone through all the examples yet in my own mind to say, is this the right way of looking at it, particularly since that the rev recognition is for determining when does the seller recognize revenue. It doesn't help you when you're the customer having to decide whether you recognize your payable or not, necessarily.
Okay, I take your point.
Yes.
Pat, did you want to come?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that point and actually ask another question that I think is related to this. As I said, the staff's view was whether or not that particular example, the towboat example, was subject to a lease was dependent on who is controlling the underlying thing. One of the suggestions that a couple of the ISB board members put on the table, and I know it was also discussed at the FASB Ed session, which I listened to, was whether or not the use of the term control should be embedded in the definition of a lease. Today, the proposal, you know, in the ED and what we're talking about doesn't have that as part of the definition. So one of the questions, and John, you teed it up perfectly, is whether or not it should, And then the question then becomes, what is that definition? Is it identical to the concept that has been developed in the RevRec standard? And I think a lot of the ISB board members think that it should be. I can't speak for the FASB, but I'm getting a sense there could be sentiment there as well. We've heard from representatives, I know, at various discussions, for example, the FEI, the CFA Institute are all kind of recommending, preparers and investors there on the same page of having a cross-cutting issue be dealt with in the same way, because lessor accounting is nothing more than revenue recognition, right? So that's, I think, also a critical issue we're going to be debating this week, and even if you don't have an answer right now, between now and the end of the week, it would be really good if this group does have a pretty good view of that, so we could push this forward. How critical is it to use the word control in the definition, or should it just be something that we apply as application guidance?
Now, while you're contemplating that, I have a couple of questions. Neri, lift your head up from that BlackBerry. I want to ask you a question first, and then you can make a comment. I think the staff you've heard are sort of recommending this sort of narrower approach, specification of the asset for the right of use. That potentially is going to have some implications for certain contracts that under current literature are classified as leases, and you use the example of take or pay contracts and
some of those
power generation contracts and so on. How do you feel about that? Do you think that's an appropriate outcome? You concerned about that impact?
Yes and no, because I think when I think about the capacity contracts, I think about the information value coming from this capacity contract, and I think what's in and out. There's a large information value associated with future commitments for certain capacities that we are gleaning, and you're not always gleaning it necessarily by the fact that you include this, at least in the financial statements, but rather from disclosure and some information about those contracts. So I'm somewhat ambivalent in the current state with respect to take or pay versus other things. The area that is perhaps more disturbing is if there's some accounting notion, if you will, that captures some notion of an asset that for some odd reason becomes a take-or-pay or a disguised take-or-pay in order to avoid going back to RAS points, whether you're trying to do something that is contradicting the current convention. But if you simply think about capacity contracts or some elements to deliver some elements of capacity, there are many others that are excluded currently from the accounts that we are very familiar with, and we are probably over the years have asked for additional disclosures in order to get some more information and glean some more information about it. So if you put them within the leasing contract, it could be useful. Why? Because it simply provides a prompt. But if you otherwise provide this information in the footnotes, personally, from our perspective, I will not be concerned. But the area that I actually wanted to chime in earlier was actually going to the principle and some discussion, and perhaps Larry's point about suggesting that can a principle be out there. So, again, from a user's perspective, I think some of it goes beyond what I can contribute to the discussion anyways. But what sounds to me that, you know, a specified asset is useful. That's where you're heading, right? You want to have some notion of specified assets. Now, to reach earlier point, the notion of, you know, if on day one you contracted for some specified capacity being an IRU, and whether there's a color today and tomorrow there's going to be some different colors, but you got to think about the intent of the parties at the day that you entered into the contract, right? So, for example, the use of this building in the example that Rich provided, if, for example, I lease this floor and later on the developer have put five more floors on top of this building, yes, you may have changed the asset. Yes, I still contracted to a particular capacity asset, specified asset, name it any way you want it. So, and I'm actually very sympathetic to Bill's earlier comment about developing a principle, being it what it is, that what's a specified asset, you take the principle, you don't take it to the extreme now, and if there are abuses in the future, you're corrected by modifying the principle and having some more guidance. So, I thought about it, and in thinking and hearing what I'm hearing, I listed a few things that I think could be useful for, you know, the boards and to think about as you're thinking to this. So one is, you know, how do you get to specified assets? So
First, I like the notion of not incidental to the service, defined as defined, because if it's part of the delivery of a service and it's clearly a service in which some cranes are being used or something else, I would exclude it somehow. Percentage-wise, principle-wise, I put everything that's being delivered as part of a service and it's somewhat of a de minimis required to be out. Why? It could be an asset, but I think it also could be practical. You got to think about some practicality within how it's being applied. Clearly, with some information and clearly with some anti-abuse provisions. Then I think the lessor ability to substitute versus the lessee's ability to substitute. I like the notion of kind of lessor controls versus the lessee control. It's being done for the convenience of the lessor. The notion of meaningfully different assets. If it's not a meaningfully different assets, it doesn't change substantially the nature of the contract. So to Rich's earlier point, if you delivered meaningfully substantially similar assets, I would still keep it within the same lease, same term, same lease, meaningfully the same asset, I would keep it the same for the same use. And then the notion of control over use, I would like to get the control because ultimately the control will also help me with the distinction between service and ownership. Because if you allow the lessee to control the use, it smells more as a lease versus allowing the lessor that could be incidental to service. Now, how you put it into a principle, I think it may be somewhat difficult, but this is kind of my own building blocks in thinking for that. I don't know if it helps you or...
It's all very helpful, yeah, Mary.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for that. Rich, I wanted to ask you a question if I could, so let's put you on air.
Okay.
You and Larry had an exchange there about the concerns you saw if you went down the alternative route, not specified asset, but specified, whatever.
Right.
And I understand your concerns, but what wasn't clear to me is which do you actually support? Are you a specified asset person or a... asset of particular specification?
I am a modified specified asset person. In other words, if you give me a choice of A and B, I'll pick specified asset. I agree with Bill. I think there's cases where it's not contractually specified, but it's specified in fact. Mm-hmm. Because the asset's been dropped off to the lessee, and the lessee has that asset, and the lessee's using that asset. So I'm modified specified asset, let's call it. Which, by the way, we worked through in practice today,
okay,
without a lot of abuses.
Thank you for that. It's clear to me now. We've only got a couple of minutes left on this issue. I wouldn't mind getting any other comments people might have on the issue that Petrina raised about whether it can be sort of a physical portion, the asset. The lease can be related to physical and non-physical portions, and we had a bit of an exchange, you and I, Rich, on that. But I'd like to hear what others might have, the views others might have on that particular issue, whether the staff are heading in the right direction. Petrina set out what their view was. Any strong objections to the direction the staff are heading on that one? Seems not. Now, David, Petrina, do you have any... you'd like to ask in addition to what we've already heard?
Maybe it's not so much a question here for now, given that we only have 2 minutes, but just so you know that unfortunately what we didn't have available for you to send you last week, but what we do have going to the boards this week is an appendix to that paper 1D that includes a number of examples where we've included under both approaches that are fleshed out in 1D. I mean, really, the approaches really draw out the difference between sticking with the sort of notion of control that we proposed in the ED and we have in current GAAP versus moving to a control, the wording around control of the use closer to revenue, and those examples sort of try to draw out some potential differences with some contracts there. So I would be keen that if you have an opportunity to look at that, and if you have any thoughts around that, obviously later this week or beyond, that would be very useful. Sorry.
All
right. I know this is going to take us over, but I think this is an important point because 018 has been a poster child of the problem that we have to deal with. And one of the major changes, I believe, and if I explain this wrong, you all, correct me, is the pricing notion and how that impacts your assessment of whether you have a lease or not. And the staff has changed it pretty dramatically, both under Proposal A as well as Proposal B. They've effectively taken the concept and said, if you're paying for the right to use, so it's an amount, you know, a specified amount, you know, then that leads you towards lease accounting, versus if the pricing arrangement is such that it's on a per unit basis or something like that, that kind of takes you out of the leasing realm. And some of the examples that Petrina was talking about, the difference in whether you get a lease or not really revolved around the pricing notion. So I guess I'm interested in your feedback on that change, because I thought the 018 working group spent a lot of time dealing with pricing to come up with the pricing mechanism that was embedded in it, and therefore, to the extent that we move off of that, you know, are we opening up Pandora's box in terms of, you know, potential problems or what have you?
Anyone like to respond to John? Did you?
Yes, Miles.
A lot of my thinking has historically been that when you have a contract that has a fixed capacity charge, you're more likely to be a lease. I think that, at least in my own mind, a lot of the separation in 018 was between capacity contracts and requirements contracts. In a requirements contract, I'll buy whatever I need from you, but I don't owe you anything if I don't need anything, versus capacity, which is take or pay, and I have essentially a fixed obligation. I've been debating in my own mind whether the deletion of that makes sense here, or whether otherwise the control notion will bring it in or not, and I don't have a good sense. I haven't commented on at this point because I'm trying to decide whether my thinking is just old thinking or not on that. But I do share your concern and question.
And is it Ben or Rich?
Rich.
Larry, just from the 018 working group, you're right. The idea was if you got into C and you were getting substantially all the output, it would be a very narrow exception to get out, because you'd already negotiated to get significantly all the economics there. And the theory was if someone got significantly all the economics and was exposed to asset risk, which you would be if you had any kind of fixed-type payment, fixed meaning fixed other than fixed per volume of output. In other words, if you had exactly a market pricing, then theoretically you weren't exposed to the asset. Or if you had simply fixed per unit of output, it was the owner of the asset who was staying exposed for the asset, not the buyer of the output. The problem with those in practice has been some people had different definitions of what fixed meant. In other words, I thought fixed meant fixed. Fixed per unit of output didn't vary no matter how much output you took. Others may have said, no, volume discounts are fine. Or a small capacity charge and then fixed. So that was the problem today. We didn't get many agreements once they were in this substantially all out under this criteria. This is what I would say in practice. So any changing of the words so that agreements that where you're getting substantially all the output get out of lease accounting, it'll probably be a significant expansion of the scope out, to be fair. I mean, we don't have many coming out today.
Point of our exchange with Neri, I think Neri was saying you are somewhat ambivalent as long as you get the information about these contracts, but that is a clear implication of the direction that the staff's heading us down.
If I can just react to it again, the anti-abuse provision could be inferred from the principle, right? So you can, going back to Bill's point, you know, if you, and this is what I think I heard here as well, you know, if the objective is to do take or pay and you take 100% and you clearly must take it because otherwise you won't exist, and the intent on day one that this take or pay contract is not because it's going to change, it's going to be very fixed for the duration of the contract, you got to think differently, right? So where are you going to put these in your thinking process, and how you translate to a principle is quite important, right? Going to Ross' point. But because of that, I don't think you should change the entire standard. I'm looking at take-or-pay contracts that are
you know, clearly variable, where you have significant discretion built into the contract, where it's substantially flexible with respect to your business model. And under those circumstances, it seems to be less contractual and less committed than otherwise would be a take or pay that's evident. This is the only provider, and you clearly, the objective is to get a contract. And I think you've got the building blocks. You can get there, and then the remainder may be more of an auditing issue rather than something that you can put initially within the standard. And also the issue is, you know, whether you can be 100% complete by addressing everything today, or you can put a reasonable standard on the road that people will put out there and then come back and say, I recognize there may be some areas at the margin that potentially can be abused. Let me think about it when it comes and then try to adopt the principle versus trying to address almost every single circumstance from the get-go. This is simply a practical way to think about the standard in and of itself.
Thanks. Philippe, then Mark, and then...
Depends whether we have still a couple of minutes on this question of capacity contracts versus identified specified asset, and maybe the staff could tell us where you are now on the time charter contracts. I don't remember the board having had much discussions about how you applied the new concept of specified asset, physically specified, identifiable, but not the capacity. So where would the time charters contracts fall, and according to whether it is a specific time each year, each week, or whatever, or whether it is a variable time that the lessee or the user would be able to choose depending on his will. Say, take a pipeline, if I have the first hour every day of that pipeline, or whether I need 1 hour each day of that pipeline at my will, does that change?
I suppose I'll be slightly indirectly, Philippe, but hopefully answer all your own questions as we go along. I suppose what I'd say is that you know, you kind of compared, say, capacity of a pipeline to some of the time charters, and I'd probably say my understanding is that it's maybe they're not exactly the same in terms of specified asset, because the time charter, I understand, is that you are contracting for, you know, all of a particular ship for a period of time. It's not that you're just contracting to get use of it for 1 hour a day or one section of it. So I think they might be slightly different. But in terms of time charter, that's actually one of the examples that we've got in the appendix to the paper 1D that we talked about today. And we have included, obviously, the staff's view on what the outcome of a time charter would be, but under both sort of what would be more what current guidance is today and the new model. All I say is you get to the same answer. Our view is that you get to the same answer under going towards sort of approach A or approach B in appendix D. As I say, that's our analysis and view.
What's the answer?
the answer that we as staff are coming to is we think it does contain a lease.
Yeah. I think you've made that clear in the papers, this board meeting.
It's, as I say, that example, but that's staff view.
Okay, Mark, and then we must move on to the next issue.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to come back to Larry on his question about pricing, because, I mean, I think that if the pricing is truly a payment for usage, I'm not sure that you have a lease, because, and I think you'll find you don't have a lease when you look at control, because I don't think that the economic benefits of the asset are flowing to the lessee. The lessor has still got the risk on that asset being underutilized. And, you know, either he's got a poorly performing asset because his lessee is choosing not to take much of the output, or else he's also selling output to somebody else. And in that case, he's the one controlling the asset and dispatching where the output goes. So you don't have a lease in that case. Again, you've got to look at the contract, but if you're just paying for usage and there's not a minimum capacity charge and so on, that's not a lease. The asset belongs to the supplier and he is selling output.
I hear you. I'm concerned about the ability to work around that through innovative pricing structures.
Okay. Why does that concern? I mean, at the end of the day, what's your concern is that some things which are leases today may not be leases tomorrow.
But those, I suspect that most of those, if they're leases today, they're operating leases, and they may become service contracts tomorrow. Well, you know, what's that? What's so bad about that? Is the aim of the project to put everything that was ever considered as a lease today on the lessee's balance sheet? I'm not sure that it is. It's to put the things on there that should be on there.
Okay, two things that sort of relate to that. Comes back to your point, Phil. We need to try and make sure we've got a robust principle. It's Neri's point as well. And there may be some disclosure issues around what you were previously getting information about that you may not be now getting under a revised leasing standard, and that's some consequentials in another area perhaps. So we need to understand that effect. Can we now move on to the issue that some of us have already been sliding into, and that's just the